It is time for Pet Files. Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us this morning, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner, chief vet at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Good morning, Jill. Good morning, Marshall.
Good morning.
You sound relaxed.
Oh, I am. I get up at 5, and I'm just, no. Yeah. Not really. I'm relaxed because I just got up.
Okay. All right. So this we have a two-parter from Jen in Brooklyn, and I don't even know how to do this. So I guess I'll read the whole thing, and then we'll just break it down piece by piece.
Sounds good.
Okay. Part one, I got a notice from the dog walking agency I use that there is an outbreak of canine influenza in my area. A Google search later, I saw it was highly contagious and sounds hard to treat. I called my vet to ask if he thought my 3-year-old corgi mix, Prudy, should get the vaccine, and when he heard how much contact she has with other dogs every week, in dog parks and on group walks, he said yes. I got her the first of 2 vaccinations today, and only now am I thinking, how do I know there really is an outbreak in my area, that it's not just a rumor? Is there some website or phone number to call like the CDC for dogs? Part 2. My impression from the internet search is that cats can catch it too. Does that mean they can catch it from an infected dog? And then is it still canine influenza or does it manifest as a different disease in cats? And would there be any reason to vaccinate a cat? Thank you, Jen in Brooklyn.
Lots of questions. There is no central, there is no CDC for dogs, but to find out locally, the best thing to do it would be to call the New York State. So I'm assuming this is, Jen is from Brooklyn. I've heard about the outbreak in Brooklyn. The state veterinary medical associations or societies usually have that information. So in New York, it would be the New York State Veterinary Medical Society to contact, but there definitely has been an outbreak of influenza in Brooklyn. And last I heard, there were 14 cases. There may have been, maybe that was last week, so there may be more at this point. And of course, it is of concern to me and my practice because we have so many people traveling with their dogs out of the city and up to this area. That I hope that answers the first part of the question as to who to contact. And then the second part was about cats.
The first part was, The second part is about cats. And but you just mentioned something. So you've got a bunch of people who are traveling up here. What do? Mass vaccination, or do you just
not mass vaccination? Question people about what their dog's potential exposure is. So if you take your dog to the dog park with a group of friends, the dog park in Sharon, and you're just going with your local friends and you use one of the areas that just for your dogs, then that's not going to be a super high risk factor. But you don't know who you're going to meet at the dog park, and you don't know where those dogs are from or who they've been exposed to. So if you spend a lot of time sort of an every other day thing at the dog park, probably a good idea to get the vaccination. If you have neighbors who have 3 dogs and they come up from Brooklyn every weekend and your dogs play together, probably not a bad idea to get the influenza vaccination. So you have to weigh your risk, and calling your veterinarian would be the way to go. All the vets in the area, I'm sure, carry the influenza vaccine, and some kennels locally are requiring it, and some of the groomers require it. So it's something that is that's been happening. The vaccine's been out there for a few years. We just haven't had a true outbreak in this area this close with dogs who are traveling, into our area. So it is of concern. I haven't seen a case. I haven't heard of a case in the area. Dogs do get fever with influenza and runny nose, cough, sometimes vomiting. In dogs, many times when they have a cough, they vomit as well. So we think that they're vomiting for some other reason, and it really is that they're gagging up mucus. So lethargy, poor appetite, those are the things to watch for. But it's a risk assessment is what is what's needed. So,
and that's done with a vet. So basically,
that seems like
a reasonable place to do it rather than with, say, you know, a Ouija board.
Mm-hmm. And cats can get influenza. There is no vaccine against it in cats. But in reality, you know, the risk is quite low. Most cats live in the house. If they are outdoors, they're pretty savvy and they're not going to be around dogs much. So your dog, if your dog is at considerable risk, your dog getting vaccinated is the buffer against your cat getting influenza.
Because the cat won't...
Because the cat's only going to get it from your dog, and your dog's out and about, right?
Right.
So if your dog is protected, then you're protecting your cat. If you're, you know, except in particular instances. But there is no way to... there is no vaccination against canine influenza in cats. And I don't think that I'm sure that I've never seen a case of influenza in cats, but theoretically it can be transmitted. And
same
just
symptoms?
Just like ferrets can get people flu. You know, you have to take precautions. But what was your question?
I said, do the cats have same symptoms? But I'm now so focused on ferret and people flu that I'm...
Yeah, cats will get a fever and upper respiratory signs mostly.
How do you know a cat has a fever?
They're very lethargic. So cats who don't get up, they usually get up and greet you at the door or are just underfoot all the time, and all of a sudden you don't know where your cat is.
Okay, so it's basically the pattern. It's a pattern change.
Sick,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
They don't want to eat.
They don't show up for their usual.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are people good? This is just a quick sidebar. Are people usually good with pattern change? One of my problems with life is that I tend to see what's not there, but I know that a lot of people just don't know what I'm talking about half the time. But that makes me really decent with pattern changes, and
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering whether
it usually takes a couple of days because we're all busy.
Okay.
So, yeah, you know, and we may make assumptions that everything's okay. So it does usually take a couple of days. So it depends. It varies quite a bit from person to person. So if you're the busy parent of three young children, you might not notice that you might assume that somebody else has fed the cat,
right.
You know. And that you fed the cat and he ate and somebody else fed the cat. So it's that kind of thing that takes a few days usually to recognize, unless they're right in your face coughing.
Right. Okay.
Coughing is an unusual sign for a cat. So that would be something that would be noticed. But cats tend to drift off and they'll be under the bed if they don't feel well.
Right.
And they're not telling anybody.
And so that's what you notice. All right. All right. So and there's no vaccine for that.
No vaccination. For cats against influenza, because it's rare enough.
Okay.
And the risk is quite low.
You did it. You did it perfectly. It worked way better than I thought it was going to work. All right. Clark and Annie in Hudson. We have a pair of rabbits that live in an outdoor hutch. Sometimes on a nice day, we put them in a chicken wire enclosure to graze. Lately, the wild rabbits on our property have gotten curious about them, and they've been pressing their faces up against the fence. I know wild rabbits can carry diseases, but I don't know if our bunnies are in any danger. Thoughts?
Yeah, I would not allow the rabbits to come in direct contact. So a good idea would be maybe a 2-foot or 3-foot out enclosure around your enclosure to keep the wild rabbits away. I'm sure there are diseases that they have it, and it's possible, you know, I'm not a bunny expert, but it's possible that the domestic rabbits are much more susceptible to those diseases where they may just be carried asymptomatically in the wildlife population. So I would not allow direct contact.
Okay. And that's very good advice about, you know, making a moat.
A moat.
An enclosure moat.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, well, I've always been big on moats. Moats, catapults, and piranha.
Oh, good.
All right.
So some piranha in there.
Well, if you've got a moat, wouldn't you?
Well, who knows if the piranha might carry canine influenza.
Yeah.
You have to be careful of that.
That's why you always have to have a vet on the squad. All right, Salmon, how are you? Okay, can you get rat bite fever from a pet rat? Asks Sam in Cornwall Bridge.
My understanding is that it is rare. It's caused by a bacterium, and it could potentially be in a pet rat, absolutely. But the disease itself in people is pretty uncommon. That is my understanding, because otherwise they wouldn't be allowed to sell pet rats to people. So you have to have a certain susceptibility, just like so many other things. You know, you've got to have a particular poor immune status or susceptible immune status, because some, I'm not sure whether it's some or all of rats carry it in their respiratory tract, but that would be a great question for
a ratologist.
Or maybe for the pet store, is that, you know, is there a test for these, for the bacterium in these rats? I think that there is. And so that would tell me that not all of them carry it. So they're asymptomatic carriers. So they carry this bacterium. If they bite you, then potentially it could get into your bloodstream and cause a problem. But it is pretty unusual. So, and pet rats who are raised as babies in a gentle manner have a very low tendency to bite. So you have to be careful with children. You know, the problem is children get pet rats and they want to pick them up and they're going to corner them. So part of this whole thing, if you really want to have a pet rat, and maybe some families can't have dogs and cats because they're so allergic, and rats can make a nice pet. But you have to be very careful about how children handle these pets. And if they're not bitten, and you use precaution about cleaning up urine, because my understanding is this can be passed in all the body secretions, and use good hygiene, then that's the safest you can be. But it is possible. I believe the question was, can you get it? And yes, potentially you can get it.
So then what you need to do is find out...
Find out the specifics. I can't tell you that specifically, but I can tell you that it's not a common disease. And so if you have a child who is immunocompromised, absolutely not the pet to get for them.
Gotcha. All right.
No turtles either. And no birds.
If you have an immunocompromised,
right.
Okay.
Sure, salmonella with turtles.
Okay.
And, you know, the birds with psittacosis potentially, although they could be tested, but it's a little bit of a gray area. So, you know, I would rather have a dog.
Something with fur?
Yeah, I mean, cats could have a tendency to scratch.
Right.
But dogs would be, you know, I think the most gentle. And, of course, there's all kinds of things that you have to be concerned about. But pets are so important in raising children, in my opinion.
Yeah, so that goes back to the risk
management. Risk versus benefit, yeah, because which has to be discussed with the child's doctor, of course.
But that also actually has to be, it's not even discussed. Life is a constant, it's an ongoing
risk. Yeah.
So if you spend all of your time eradicating risk, then you are missing a good half of it.
Right.
I mean, I'm not saying be stupid, I'm just saying you've got to do the assessment, and sometimes you've got to just say, okay, well, you know, Think of a plan B if it goes sideways, is what I'm trying to say.
Right, and the rat bite, going back to rat bite fever, that it is treatable. You know, such a bacterium can be treated with penicillin, I think, antibiotics.
Yeah.
So it's not a fatal disease. Very, I suppose it could be in an immunocompromised child.
Well, Sam in Cornwall Bridge, who's writing, does not sound like an immunocompromised child.
Okay.
Here, you know what? In this land of total nuance, Sam could be Samantha, and Sam could be asking about her child. So
true. And, you know, when you're a mother and you have a child who has some sort of a disability, whether it be immune in their immune system or not, then it is a really serious concern.
That is true. And I'm not, in that instance, I'm not minimizing it. I'm just talking about, at all, I am just speaking on a more global level, it's like, okay, if I get this, then this, then if, then if, then, and you
can absolutely
talk yourself out of doing it. It's the point of the pet, and having some other creature in the household that needs to be taken care of really shifts the dynamic, and that's critically important when you ship the kids out into life, is all I'm trying to say.
I get that.
So, all right. So off rat bite fever, and rat rhymes with, here we go. And I'm curious about this because I have a real life story that goes with this question. Zoe in Albany, a bat got stuck in our house the other day and flapped around for hours before we finally caught him and got him out. My husband is worried because we have a young child and he's concerned the bat might have had rabies. Is there anything to worry about even though the bat didn't bite anybody?
Well, potentially you could worry. I've had a bat caught in my house several times, and you know, if we can catch it, then we put it outside. If it looks healthy and is alive after all the stress of being caught, you know, if you have a bat that's flopping around on the floor and obviously ill, should be caught, and whether anyone thinks they got a bite or not, it should be tested. So if you wake up in the morning and this bat is flopping around on your bed and you can easily catch it, then it's a sick bat. And you should call your veterinarian. They'll hook you up with the state center that would test the bat for rabies. So that is for sure. So, you know, it's a somewhat of a judgment call. If you've got a bat that's obviously super healthy and it's been, your kid's door was closed all night and the bat's been in the living room, so you're pretty sure that there's been no contact whatsoever, then having a difficult time catching this lively bat, then in my opinion, throwing it out the door would be okay. But really, I should be telling you, you should be checking with your pediatrician, because I can't give you that advice.
Okay.
Does that make sense? So,
yep.
You know, again, you have to weigh what is the risk. Now, theoretically, since rabies is carried in the saliva, number one, in order to catch rabies, any animal that you're exposed to would have to have the virus in their saliva. And so they actually have to have rabies. So you can't just sort of carry rabies. You have to have rabies. And so typically they're not well if they have virus in the saliva. So you keep that in mind. Same thing with dogs. And that's why when a dog bites, we have to quarantine them for a period of 10 days, and if they've bitten someone and 10 days later they're still alive and healthy, then they couldn't have transmitted rabies to that person. So same idea with the bats, although, you know, there have been historically stories of people, just a single person anyway, going into a bat cave and contracting rabies without being bitten. So with all of that in mind, I think that calling the doctor is the best way to go before you let that bat go.
Call the midwife.
All right. I hate to kill bats because we don't have very many.
Right. And you need, so my bat story was, the bat was actually, it was in camp and it flew in and flew out and they still took all the kids for shots.
Oh, wow.
And that was just so, to me, extreme. It was like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, there's risk in rabies vaccination, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And that's, so once I think we're having.
This was 100 years ago, though, I'm sure, when you were a kid?
Oh, no.
Oh.
No, this was a.
This was something you read about recently?
No, this was a helicopter parent. Sorry. This was a parent's kid. This was, I would say this was 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
No more, no less, and it was in
Maine.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's, you know, and the problem, they're not called helicopter parents anymore. Now they're called bulldozer parents because, you know, they only want what they want. And so you're in a position where it's harder to do risk reward. But the bat wasn't in there for long enough to
and you're camping.
And you're camping.
I can remember a bat kidding, twice, two times when I was a kid, running up the road in the dark, running home and having a bat hit me in the head, which was a weird experience.
Yeah, that is weird.
We had a lot of bats back then, though. They were everywhere, and they were flying down, swooping down, catching
little voles,
catching bugs.
Yeah, bugs. And,
yeah.
And, I mean, they're actually pretty cool. And then, of course, somebody left the door open here, and there were about a million bats at the radio station, and that's a Marshall story for later, but that person...
They're lovely and necessary creatures.
Yeah, and they're actually pretty cool looking, as long as they are not, you know, in your face, or, as you say, flopping around on your bed, or like,
yeah.
clearly unhappy.
Right.
But that's a hard one. So I've got two more minutes and no more questions. So that means it's a freestyle question. Ask the vet. All right. And so here's the freestyle question. Ask the vet. Doggy with an upset stomach. And we do this from we do this all the time. But my sister got to Chicago with her beloved Penelope, and Penelope just had one day a really bad stomach. And, you know, she didn't,
eating, not eating.
No,
and...
she actually had diarrhea all over everything.
Oh,
and she ate sort of, she ate a little bit. But, mm-hmm. but again, it was more of a situation where, you know, what do you have? What if anything should you have on hand?
So if Penelope's a little dog and traveling and gets nervous traveling, I don't know if Penelope a little dog.
Penelope is a little dog, and she is not. She's a very good traveler, and
okay.
My guess would have been, and this is actually the crux of the question. My guess is she got into something on a walk because this only emerged when my sister got home and found, you know, poop everywhere.
I see.
So it's sort of like, okay, what do you do?
So, yeah, so usually a little bit of investigation with people to find out whether it is with small dogs, anxiety-induced diarrhea is not uncommon, and sometimes with bigger dogs, too. And so trying to discern that, because typically you're not getting really severe bacterial toxins or anything. But if they've eaten something... and it causes just diarrhea and no vomiting, and they're acting fine, then, you know, you can call and see if it's okay, depending on your particular dog, to give a little bit of kaopectate. But typically, if they're vomiting, we don't...
No, that's a whole other story.
That's a whole other deal.
This is
yes.
just like, oh, wow, I'm, you know, staying at a friend's. That's the question. It's like,
and my dog has diarrhea.
And my dog is
diarrhea.
Yeah, and they're going all over the house, and something's gonna give. What, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, a little bit of kaopectate, one or two doses would be fine, as long as your dog's not getting sicker.
Right.
So, you know, and as long as your dog's not on other medication. That might not absorb if you're giving kaopectate with it, et cetera, et cetera. But if you have a perfectly healthy young dog, and think in terms also of saving some stool for a parasite check.
Right.
You know, a dose of kaopectate is not going to be contraindicated very often. You're going to look at your dose for what you weigh and sort of downsize it.
Sounds perfectly reasonable. Thank you very much, Dr. Cannon.
You're welcome.
This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.